This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is out today. And we will begin with our week in review, which must begin with Hurricane Sandy and its impact on lives, coastlines, power lines, and presidential politics.
We are here for you. And we will not forget. We will follow up to make sure that you get all the help that you need until you've rebuilt.
That, of course, was President Barack Obama promising help from FEMA, while former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney was pressed to share his stance on cutting FEMA's funding.
Governor, you said 14 times today what you do with FEMA. What's your response? Why won't you answer any questions at all?
And in Massachusetts, most residents are back with their power, but 1,800 customers statewide are still in the dark.
I have no idea when power's coming on, so I don't think there is any communication at this point.
Also, why there won't be a rain date for the fourth and final debate in the Massachusetts race for the U.S. Senate.
People know where we stand on the issues. I'm going to continue to do my job.
Plus, the Massachusetts Pharmacy Board agrees to tougher regulations for the state's compounding pharmacies. Those are the stories we will discuss and more in our Week in Review. And joining us to do so now is Callum Borchers, political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Great to see you as always, Callum.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Great to see you. Also with us from Rhode Island Public Radio, 88.1 in Providence, is Scott McKay, political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio. Scott, great to have you back on Radio Boston. Welcome.
Always good to be on with you, Meghna.
It's terrific to have you. So let's start off, as we said, the way the week did, and that, of course, is with Hurricane Sandy, one of the largest storms ever to hit the eastern United States. At its height, hundreds of thousands of people in Massachusetts and more than 7 million others up and down the eastern seaboard lost power. Here's National Grid spokesperson Charlotte McCormick, who spoke with us on Monday just before Sandy made landfall, about what power customers could expect.
Given the magnitude of this storm and the breadth of the storm, I know it's not what customers want to hear, but we're asking them to be prepared for extended outages.
Well, a couple days later, Paul Moruzzi was still waiting for National Grid to restore power to his Upton home on Wednesday.
The most frustrating thing is they still haven't made any real progress in getting information out to customers. And it would be better if they just said, well, we don't know. They should all be back on within, 3 days.
Well, Callum, let's start with you. How did you weather the storm, and what's your take on its impact here in Massachusetts?
Oh, no complaints here. I had maybe a flicker of brownout here and there, but we never actually lost power. But about 380,000 people in Massachusetts did. So that number was quite high. But, to the utility's credit, I think the number this morning is down to about 1,500. So they've really gotten just about everybody back online.
Pretty quickly bouncing back in comparison to other storms that Massachusetts has been hit with in the past. We'll come back to that in a second. But Scott, let me check in with you. I mean, Providence has been walloped in the past in history with big hurricanes. How was it down there?
Well, it's interesting. The south coast of Rhode Island, people who vacation here and go to the beach will know the names like Mesquamacat, Matunuck, Easton's Beach in Newport, Watch Hill. All those areas just got pounded, and there's been some devastating loss of property and businesses. Now, luckily, we didn't lose any lives, but there's real need for rebuilding. And also, a lot of soil erosion and sand erosion on those beaches. It's going to be very difficult to get all that ready for the next tourist season. Now, that said, the Narragansett Bay communities, which, as you point out, in the past, 1938 hurricane, 1954, 1991, really this time didn't get hit very hard. I live in Bristol overlooking the bay, and really there were some high tides. They closed the bridge, but that was about it. We lost power for 3 or 4 hours. And Providence, they closed the hurricane barrier for the first time in many, many, many years, but nothing came up the bay. And frankly, the bay communities did much better than the south coast communities of Rhode Island, where there's a real major cleanup problem.
Cleanup problem. So overall, Rhode Island, I mean, depending on where you live, it sounds like some people still today aren't too happy with the recovery efforts.
Well, it's difficult. I think that utilities probably doing the best they can. One of the things was some of the property owners were upset that they couldn't get back to their property as quickly as they would have liked to. But, we lost roads. I mean, you should see Block Island, the main road there. Corn Neck Road is half into Fred Benson Beach. You look at the South Coast, and there's going to be, there's some real problems there. You've got hotels washed into the ocean. You've got a big restaurant, the Coast Guard House, down there that's half gone. Water came through. All these kind of iconic business places that people who summer along the Rhode Island mm-hmm. shore will notice.
Well, Callum, here in Massachusetts, I know that the utilities started something new this year, and that is sending out repair crews and tree crews together so that places where power lines were downed by trees, they could actually take care of both problems at once. And that seems to have helped. But we also heard in the middle of the week from WBUR's Deborah Becker, who was in central Massachusetts, that a lot of people there feel like it didn't help enough, that still there's this lingering sense that there's a lack of communication and speed when it comes to getting regions back up on their feet with power after storms like this.
Yeah, I mean, the reviews have been mixed for sure. And as we said, it's better than it has been in the past. So, I mean, if you compare to Hurricane Irene last year, much better than that. National Grid, within 36 hours, had about 3/4 of its customers back on power. That's compared to only 57% after Irene last year. NSTAR was even better, 82% back this time within 36 hours compared to only 2/3 with Irene last year. But a lot of folks still aren't happy. And if you haven't, by the way, yet read Brian McGrory's column today in the Globe, it's worth picking up the paper just for that. He called it Diary of a Powerless Man. And it's just it's absolutely hilarious. Basically, he describes what he considers to be his best idea ever, which is that the next time we have a big storm like this, we're going to cut the power lines to the utility CEOs and to the governor. And they don't get their power back until everybody else does.
Thomas May, you've been warned.
That's
over
right.
At NSTAR. Well, I mean, but all that taken into account, the further south that you look, you know, down to New Jersey and New York, I mean, it's almost like a disaster area down there. Mayor Michael Bloomberg from New York today said that Con Ed hopes to have power restored to most of Manhattan by midnight tonight, still many, many days after Hurricane Sandy made landfall. That's just one of the sort of the ongoing impacts of this storm. Let's move to another one, which is, of course, politics, because Sandy brought everything to a halt, including electioneering. It had an effect on the campaigns. Question is, what effect that exactly is? So first, did it help President Obama look more presidential? Here he is in New Jersey on Wednesday.
We are here for you. And we will not forget. We will follow up to make sure that you get all the help that you need until you've rebuilt.
Scott, what do you think? More presidential?
Well, of course. And the other thing it gave him the opportunity to do, particularly in New Jersey, was to appear as a bipartisan person with, of course, Governor Chris Christie, a conservative Republican, who was the keynote speaker at the Republican convention and, of course, was very critical of President Obama. And Christie had to go so far as to praise the response of President Obama and his administration. But look, is it really going to move undecided voters? If Obama's got a problem in New York or New Jersey, he's not going to win the election.
Right.
Okay? And I think you must be living in a yurt if you're still undecided at this point.
Callum, your take on this regarding President Obama?
I guess to take the opposite side, the counterargument would be that he lost 3 days of campaigning in crucial swing states where the polls show things are really tightening up. Even some of the states that we thought were pretty safely in his column, like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Minnesota. I mean, the Romney campaign believes that they've now got chances to pull off upsets in those states. Those polls are much tighter than they were 3 and 4 weeks ago, and he lost 3 days there.
Do you think that the chance, as Scott was saying, for President Obama to absolutely look more presidential, to look more bipartisan, to look like the man in charge, could have any effect in maybe counteracting the nosedive his poll numbers took after the first debate? I mean, that seems like so long ago, but the Obama that we're seeing now is absolutely a different person than those undecided voters saw in the first debate, Callum.
Well, it helps because it's another big moment where he's really in the national spotlight, and we talk about voters by now are really fatigued. They've seen a lot of ads and whatnot. And if folks are just sort of casually paying attention, one of the big nights that they were to tune in was that first debate, right? And if they just watched that, they didn't get the best impression of the president. Without this storm, you might not have had a big spotlight moment for Obama before Election Day. And that storm provided this.
Yeah. Scott, do you think those yurt voters, you may have just coined a new phrase there, that anything could penetrate their undecidedness now? I mean, we've just got a couple days left.
I can't figure it out. I mean, today we had another jobs report, and some people are going to say, well, there's more jobs than people expected. Other side's going to say, we're still not in a full-blown recovery. So we keep having these kind of vague signals. Mm-hmm. And like I say, I don't know what the undecided person needs to make up his or her mind, but we're getting close.
Well, so we took a look just now at the impact that Sandy may have had on President Barack Obama. It may have actually put former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney in a more difficult situation, especially because Mitt Romney is actually on the record regarding his desire to cut funding for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, of course. So here's what he said to CNN's John King during a GOP primary debate last year.
Every time you have an occasion to take something from the federal government and send it back to the states, that's the right direction. And if you can go even further and send it back to the private sector, that's even better. We're borrowing $1.6 trillion more this year than we're taking in.
Including disaster relief.
We cannot afford to do those things without jeopardizing the future for our kids. It is simply immoral.
Now, Hurricane Sandy put that question of morality back into very sharp relief for Mitt Romney, to the point where he was actively avoiding repeated questioning from the press about his views of FEMA now.
Governor, would you eliminate FEMA if you were president?
Governor, are you going to eliminate FEMA?
Governor, you said 14 times today what you do with FEMA. What's your response? Why won't you answer any questions on it?
So that bit of tape might have been a little hard to hear, but that last reporter asked Governor Mitt Romney, you were asked 14 times today what you'd do with FEMA. What's your response? Why won't you answer any questions of it? Scott, could this end up dogging Romney in the last couple of days of this campaign?
Well, this has been part of the Mitt Romney dilemma and why some people see him as a chameleon on a plaid couch. And to win the Republican primaries, he had to swerve very far to the right, appeal to the Tea Party people, appeal to Southerners. And, of course, now it's a general election, and we've seen, what's the nickname, Moderate Mitt, the Massachusetts governor. We've seen the Mitt Romney that we in New England knew as a fairly moderate governor coming back to the center to try to get independent voters and undecided people. And this is part of that dilemma. He's had to kind of, you know, do this slalom course from the primary right-wing Mitt to what we see now as someone who's more moderate, and obviously, when something of this magnitude happens, you just can't say, no, let's get rid of FEMA. I mean, otherwise, you bring up the disaster of Katrina. And frankly, you know, no one wants to relive that kind of a response to a tragedy.
I take your point, Scott, but Callum, Mitt Romney's saying nothing. I mean, reporters were really asking him a lot of questions about this, and he literally was just thanking people and moving on to the next person, you know, in the line. Given how much political coverage there has been about this race and about Sandy, did it really have, you think it may have very minimal effect? Because as Scott was saying, people are just so used to seeing Romney do the slalom course.
Well, I think it would have been less effect if he'd sort of come out with one strong explanation one way or the other. I mean, people can understand, obviously, in the aftermath of a hurricane, it's never going to be popular to say that we're going to reduce funding to FEMA. But, you know, he can make a case for it if he wants to. But I think that folks would like to just say, if you believe that, say so, and just tell us and, you know, give us your point. To avoid the question 14 times, and, you know, if you looked at the statement his campaign put out on Monday versus the one he put out on Wednesday, there was a real change of focus there. The first one was still saying, I believe the states should take chief responsibility. Then on Wednesday, it was, you know, I strongly support that FEMA plays a key role. I'll make sure they have all the funding that they need. So the messaging wasn't really consistent.
Well, let's move on if we can to state-level politics and at least Senate-level politics, because inevitably Hurricane Sandy also left flotsam and jetsam all over the race for the Massachusetts Senate seat. Senator Scott Brown and Democratic challenger Elizabeth Warren canceled their final debate. WBUR was a co-sponsor of that, I should say. It was supposed to take place this week. Here's Senator Brown in Westport on Tuesday.
The act of God, we had obviously a major event here in the eastern United States, and I thought we both agreed appropriately to cancel it. You know, there's only a few days left, and we have a very, very busy schedule, as I'm sure my opponent does. So I'll refer that to the campaign. People know where we stand on the issues. I'm going to continue to do my job.
Well, Elizabeth Warren told reporters at the United Fishermen's Club in New Bedford yesterday that she's willing to reschedule the final debate, but that she couldn't because Scott Brown declined.
The consortium said, we'll do this on Thursday, and I immediately said, yes, that's fine. And Senator Brown said no to all dates. I think that speaks for itself.
Well, the exact timeline, because we know this because WBR, again, was a co-sponsor of this debate, is that Elizabeth Warren's campaign said yes to a Thursday event, but only after Senator Scott Brown had said no. But regardless, Callum, let's start with you. It doesn't sound as if either candidate in this close race that Globe poll has them neck and neck really wants to stand up in front of a moderator.
I think that's right. I mean, and let's remember, they've had three debates already. They've been campaigning for a long time. So there is something to be said for the notion that, you know, folks have got a pretty good feel for both candidates at this point. I do think, though, that one thing that hurts Brown is he looks like the one out of the two who has declined the debate. That could potentially hurt him. And also the rationale behind it. It's not so much that they're not having this debate, but that it's because I had a bus tour already scheduled. Remember, he's a colonel in the National Guard. You know, if he had said, I'm busy because of that responsibility, or I'm busy because of my Senate duties, folks would be very understanding. But when the explanation is simply, I can't because I was scheduled to drive around on my bus campaigning for votes, people might be a little bit less impressed.
Scott, what does Rhode Island make of the Senate rate in Massachusetts?
Well, there's so many commercials here in the Providence market because both sides, and on our radio stations, because what happens is, even the Joe Kennedy race for Congress, the people who do this work know that it's much cheaper to buy Providence Market Media than it is in Boston. And yet, so much of our media here reaches southeastern Massachusetts that we get a lot of the campaign stuff. And we're just hit with this every single day, back and forth, I swear. Scott Brown's pro-choice. No, Scott Brown hates women. I mean, it just goes back and forth. And it never really ends. Obviously, on the debate question, candidates and their professionals, people around them, don't like debates too late in a campaign, because then if there's a gaffe, they don't have time to clean it up. And so that's why I think Colm's right in saying that in the end, neither side really, really wanted to have this. But in the campaign interplay and the jousting that goes on, I think the Warren people are only too happy to have Brown come out first and cancel it.
We are almost there. And on behalf of the voters of Massachusetts, we apologize to the Ocean State for flooding your airwaves with so many ads. But in the last couple of minutes that we have here, I do want to touch upon a very serious national story that has also emerged from Massachusetts. And that is, of course, new developments surrounding the New England Compounding Center. And that's the Framingham Pharmacy at the center of a national meningitis outbreak that has so far left 28 people dead and more than 300 people sick. This week, Ameridose, the Westboro-based sister company to the NECC, has voluntarily recalled all of its unexpired medications. In a press release on Wednesday, Ameridose said, quote, that it has not received any adverse reports related to its products. Nevertheless, out of an abundance of caution, we are undertaking this recall to assure customers that when Ameridose products are shipped, they are fully in conformance with all FDA recommendations. So, Callum, interesting, the sister company here, Ameridose, recalling its product, abundance of caution, it seems like a wise but possibly even belated move.
It does. And the flip side of it is that the Massachusetts Hospital Association now is concerned about a shortage of these injectable prescription drugs, because they have also recalled their products, even though they've found no problems. So I'm sort of torn on this one, Meghna, right? I mean, it does seem like the prudent thing to do. And certainly from a PR standpoint, it looks good. It looks like you're really doing the right thing and trying to really protect consumers. But having a shortage of drugs in the market isn't a good thing either.
Mm. And Scott, Congressman Ed Markey announced yesterday that he's filing legislation to really fill the regulatory black hole, as it's been called, that these compounding pharmacies have fallen into, where they're not really looked over by the FDA and not really by the state. I mean, it's inevitable that such legislation would have to be filed. But, you know, do you think it's going to make much of a difference right now?
Well, not in the short run. Of course, as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long term, we're all dead. But the fact is, look, 37 million of these prescriptions are out there, and obviously the FDA ought to be taking a look at that. So I think Markey's probably on the right course, but it may not help things, as Colm alluded to, in the short term here when people need care.
And this is a story that I feel like is going to go on and on and on, because it's really just laid bare, Callum, that there's just so much in terms of the creation and manufacturing of medicines these days that, you know, we don't really understand all that much of from a regulatory standpoint.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the big distinctions in the regulatory world seems to be between a compounding center and a manufacturer, right? So these compounding centers can only produce their drugs with a specific patient's prescription in mind. They can't sort of mass produce in advance. That's a different license, I guess, than being a manufacturer. But to an outsider, as a consumer, you sort of say, so what's the big deal? But it seems to be a very big deal. And so I think that we're all sort of learning as we go show here.
Mm. Well, we've got a couple minutes left, and that's just enough time to do our weekly hubbubs, and that's the news that may not have floated above the fold, as they say in the newspaper industry. So, Scott, what's your hubbub for today?
Well, there's a lot of talk about David Ortiz being a free agent, but let's look at the subplot here. The Red Sox pretty much have to re-sign him because he's become the good face of what lately has been a bad team, and I'd be very surprised if they did not re-up David Ortiz for another couple of years.
Would you be surprised, Callum?
I would not be at all surprised, although I sort of agree. I think the Sox are sort of in a spot where they have to bring this guy back. He had a fantastic season until he blew out his Achilles, so you know, I think he's still got a few homers left in him, I think.
Yep.
So, Callum, what's your hubbub?
Well, to come back to Sandy, it sort of dominated my week, actually, and I was really interested by this sort of Obama-Chris Christie, odd couple this week, right? And the question, of course, was, is it genuine? You know, because there's political strategy for both sides. Obama wants to look presidential right before a race. Chris Christie is maybe positioning himself for a run in 2016 or 2020, so there's always that inside. But I had a fascinating conversation this week with a political scientist at UNLV. Of course, Nevada's an important swing state, mm-hmm. Ted Gelin. And he said, you know, we do tend to be cynical about these things, but consider this, they might actually mean it. And I really got a kick out of that. And I had to say, I stepped back and I said, you know what, even if they don't mean it, I don't care. The fact is, they seem to put aside politics for a few days. I doubt that they've genuinely become close friends out of this. But they seem to have a good working relationship. And ultimately, that's what we elect these people to do. So whether it was genuine or not, perhaps is beside the point.
Hope springs eternal, does it not?
That's right.
And let me say, they might actually mean it right now.
They mean it right now. Right. That's right. And for the folks who are without power and food and water, that's really all that matters.
Yeah. Well, my hubbub also has to do with politics and its effect on four-year-olds, because you may have heard of a young girl named Abigail Evans from Colorado, because a video of her went viral this week. Let's listen to the video first.
Just because I'm tired of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney.
That's why you're crying? Oh, it'll be over soon, Abby. Okay? The election will be over soon, okay?
Okay.
Oh, poor Abigail Evans. And if it wasn't bad enough that listening about, quote, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney put her to tears, Scott, for you and me, the heartbreak was that she was listening to NPR in the car. When no, she started crying.
This is not the kind of driveway moment we talk about.
No, not at all. And this got me thinking, and a lot of people did mention this online as well, that, you know, in a political season when passions are extreme and maybe there's some a lot of speech and analysis that a four-year-old can't really take on board, parents do need to remember that that there's a little person sitting in the back and they don't know how to think about these things, and it might actually be quite emotionally disturbing for them. That was a serious note. But I also found out that an NPR or a Colorado Public Radio reporter visited young Abigail Evans and gave her a little NPR pin, and all is well now.
Oh, wow.
And NPR actually said that they're sorry on a blog on NPR.org as well.
Okay.
And for Abby's good and for everyone else's good, we are almost there. November 6th is just a couple days away. And on that note, I'm going to say thank you to Scott McKay, political analyst for Rhode Island Public Radio. Always great to have you, Scott. Thanks so much.
Always great to be with you.
And Callum Borchers, political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Great to see you as well. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Megan. Hang in there, Abby.
Well, listeners, when we come back, we'll talk about Facebook and how one post actually brought an end to high school bullying. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.